unimaginable 13 months ago is here. Is now back to just punting and kicking off. The former Saint Morton Anderson is here for most field goals.
I would have been in San Diego, California. I was playing for the San Diego Chargers. We would have been getting ready for our first game of the season.
I was coaching in Dallas, and we would have been in our preseason training camp.
I was in my house in France. We were between two legs of a tour, and we were recuperating after a long and hard first leg. And first caught the news that there was this hurricane on its way to New Orleans, and then, you know, turned on the news channels and just watched as this horror unfolded.
I was doing a full season of college football on Thursday nights and Saturdays, and that's where we were getting our season started. So, like many, not in the Gulf Coast area, you were a prisoner to cable news and what was going on, and it was hard to go to sleep because you were just watching and waiting and wondering with everyone else. And as we know, we didn't find out really until the next day began how bad the night was.
The team had just evacuated a day or two before that, so we were in the San Francisco Bay Area ahead of a preseason game against the Raiders.
I was in a fetal position in a hotel room in New York City.
But I remember waking up that morning at about 5 a.m. and looking out my window and seeing the trees bent over double and the rain pouring down. So that was a day that I'll never forget.
Hurricane Katrina, which started out as a tropical wave off the western coast of Africa, passed over South Florida as a Category 1 hurricane, moved into the Gulf of Mexico, and then came ashore at Buras, Louisiana at 6 a.m. August 29, 2005. After reaching Category 5 status in the Gulf, it was a Category 3 storm when it slammed into the Louisiana and Mississippi coasts with 125-mile-per-hour winds, laying waste to everything in its path. New Orleans was buffeted with hurricane-force winds and heavy rains, but because it was on the western side of Katrina's eye, the area was spared the full force of the storm. The initial reports were that the city had dodged a major bullet. It hadn't.
When I got word that the levees had broke and the streets were flooding and neighborhoods were completely flooding, that's when we got real scared and really there was a lot of concern. I mean, a lot of concern for our employees, a lot of concern obviously for our fans and the neighbors and everything else. But like everyone else, I mean, it was beyond comprehension.
To see that really as a place of survival and the shredding of the top, the skin of the roof, and those pictures. Of course, the other ones were haunting. But for me, having spent a lot of time in the dome, covering sports, as a sports fan as well, those were the ones that just allowed me to understand the enormity of what was going on here.
For The Edge, it triggered memories of U2's Super Bowl 36 performance at the Superdome in 2001. And how, in a twist of fate, being in New Orleans for that gig saved most of his key instruments from being lost in a flood that swamped the band's storage facility in Dublin.
So in some ways, New Orleans saved my most precious guitars and amps, because had I not been there performing Super Bowl or Superdome, I would have lost them all. So here I'm looking at New Orleans, and it's going through a flood, and I couldn't help but think, oh my God, this is, in my mind, or in many people's mind, the city, the music city of the United States of America, maybe one in the world, maybe, you know, the most important music city in the world. What's happening here is like 1,000 times worse, and I just couldn't help but think about all the musicians that left their instruments behind, destroyed in this flood.
Halfway across the country, Saints players and coaches were trying to come to grips with what they were watching on TV.
The morning after the storm hit, we were getting ready for practice in the hotel there near Oakland, and we had the TVs on as we were getting taped up. I remember coming down the hotel stairs and hearing that the levees had broken. Everyone was trying to contact their families and figure out what the status of their houses were. It was pretty much chaos from that point, and the chaos continued for several months.
You know, we had finished the 2004 season 8-8, but we had won our last four games, three on the road. So we went into this 2005 season feeling like, hey, we've got a chance to be a decent, a good football team. And man, you know, then all of a sudden we're practicing on a high school field. We're concerned. There's concern about families, about the people, our friends in New Orleans, and all the things that happened that were very distracting to our football team. So it was really kind of an unfair circumstance for a team, difficult.
Somehow, the Saints won their first game in Carolina when John Kearney drilled a winning field goal with 3 seconds to play. Kearney's embrace with quarterback Aaron Brooks was immortalized on the cover of that week's Sports Illustrated. Then they went to New York to play in a home game against the Giants.
We meet with the teams, coaches, and players for every game, you know. And the meeting with Jim Haslett, I'll never forget how distraught he was about, San Antonio welcomed the team, but the circumstances in which they were welcomed and what they had to deal with. You know, practicing in the concourse of the Alamo Dome, I remember going to a local gym to train, to work out, practicing on high school fields, never having a home game.
The team had a 6-game and a 5-game losing streak, with half-attended home games at Tiger Stadium and lackluster efforts at the Alamo Dome in San Antonio. Matters weren't helped when Deuce McAllister, star running back, locker room leader, tore his ACL in a loss to the Green Bay Packers. The season ended with a 27-13 loss to the Tampa Bay Buccaneers on January 1st. The Saints were 3-13. General Manager Mickey Loomis took quick action, firing coach Jim Haslett, who had the impossible task of trying to lead a team that had no home, no real training facilities, and was missing its best player.
It was a long, unsuccessful year.
Our equipment assisted in clearing streets to where Entergy could restore power to homes. I was at the game.
It was definitely a big to-do. I had a t-shirt on that said Home Sweet Dome on it.
There's no way that Atlanta could win this game with it being the reopening of the Superdome.
The blocked punt was just the cherry on top.
And all the emotion of the city just erupted. That was like a starting point of everybody's healing.
I mean, this has become the newest old city in the world.
The Superdome dominates the New Orleans skyline. The brainchild of visionary Dave Dixon and the creation of the architectural firm of Curtis and Davis, the Superdome came to life on August 3rd, 1975, a state-of-the-art dome structure that appeared had descended from outer space and taken up residence at the end of Poydras Street.
It was just a magnificent looking structure. It was an indoor hard-walled and hard-roofed building. It was very much ahead of its time when it was built. It wasn't an air-supported dome. It just had this sense of permanence and wonder about it.
The Superdome immediately became the home of the Saints, Tulane football, the Sugar Bowl, and more. And while it was truly a multi-purpose stadium, baseball and basketball games were played under its expansive roof. For New Orleanians, it was the home of the Saints.
So much more than a building. It's really a temple, if you will, for the community. Everyone comes together. I mean, there's a handful of landmarks in town, the cathedral and the Superdome. And when you look up the word definition of a landmark, it truly is a landmark for us, both, I think, emotionally and spiritually and community-wise.
It's like a heart to the city, you know. If you're flying from the sky or whatever it may be and looking down, I look at the Superdome like as a heart to the city.
But the savage beating the Superdome took from the winds of Katrina and the resulting floodwaters caused by the failure of the levee system, combined with the horror experienced by the thousands of people who eventually took refuge there, caused many to question whether the building could or should be repaired.
I think if you're on the outside looking in, you don't know the spirit of the place and the spirit of the people, more importantly, I think you should have had doubts.
As we did the damage assessment, we realized that that the mechanical systems and the electrical systems were fairly well intact. It was just the interior spaces that needed to be replaced. We brought in a team of engineers, 16 specialty consultants from around the country. Took them over a month to crawl through this building with flashlights to determine that it could be salvaged. And I remember the day very well. It was September 30th when Paul Griesmer with L.B. Beckett, the architectural firm that we brought in, said to me, "It probably can be saved. It's going to take over 2 years. It'll take well over $200 million, but that's assuming that you don't have severe damage to your mechanical systems and you can get rid of the mold." So that was our first glimmer of hope.
Governor Kathleen Blanco turned hope into reality.
And I just kept thinking that the people of New Orleans deserved a symbol of hope, a demonstration that this city could be brought back and brought back more quickly than anyone ever imagined. I was willing to take the chances that if we invested that kind of commitment, that the Saints would also make that commitment.
That commitment was affirmed by NFL Commissioner Paul Tagliabue.
He said, if you can get the building up for the first regular game in the 2006 season on September 25th, he said, I will guarantee you that Tom Benson won't even think about leaving.
We asked Governor Blanco to sign an executive order in early December 2005, and that was critical to this project. Without that executive order, we wouldn't have been able to fast-track the construction.
It was gigantic. You know, there had been, again, there was so much discussion prior to the hurricane on whether or not the Saints would be here in the long term.
The Superdome was going to be rebuilt. Now the Saints had to build a new and improved team. On January 6th, 2006, the Saints and the NFL held a joint press conference announcing plans for the 2006 season. On January 19th, Loomis and owner Tom Benson introduced Sean Payton as the franchise's 10th full-time head coach.
Well, the organization where he was, they were praising him so much, I was a little bit concerned.
While Payton came with a strong endorsement from Bill Parcells, no one knew if the fresh-faced offensive play caller would work, and the hire almost didn't happen.
At the end of the season, I had an interview with Green Bay and then had spoken to Mickey about taking an interview with the Saints afterwards, and then I was going to Buffalo after New Orleans.
You know, that was an interesting process we went through because, first of all, there was a lot of jobs open that year, 10 as I recall. And, you know, if you lined up in order of attractiveness, we were probably 10th given the circumstances. But, you know, I knew we needed a lot of energy. And so I felt like, you know, we wanted to go with a young coach that had a lot of energy. I was looking on the offensive side of the ball. We had dinner and it was a quick 3-hour visit. And yet, man, I remember after that meeting that this is our guy.
Once Payton came on board, the real work began, hiring a staff and building the team. Gary Gibbs was the first hire as defensive coordinator. Then veteran Joe Vitt signed on to be the assistant head coach and oversee the linebackers.
There's a scene in Jerry Maguire where the main character, Tom Cruise, leaves the law firm and he grabs the fish and he says, "Who's coming with me?" And it's like crickets. It's quiet, you know, and then at some point, Renee Zellweger says, "I'll go." It was a little bit like that.
There was a number of coaches that saw the condition of the city and didn't want any part of it. And yet there was a number that wanted to come, and, and felt like, hey, this was not just coaching a football team, but there was a little higher purpose in coming to New Orleans and helping the city recover.
With the staff in place, the next order of business was finding a quarterback to replace Aaron Brooks. Peyton and Loomis quickly focused on Drew Brees, who just had his shoulder severely mangled in the final game he played in the 2005 season for the San Diego Chargers. With his shoulder, which had recently been repaired by noted orthopedic surgeon James Andrews, Brees had a limited market. The Saints and the Miami Dolphins, coached by Nick Saban, were the only two serious players.
We were really concerned, and man, we had a lot of doctor's reports. We did a lot of due diligence on that, not just on the injury, but on Drew himself. And what we found was, you know, a young man who always defied the odds to be successful. And we knew it wasn't going to be a matter of lack of effort. He was going to do everything he could to get his shoulder back to where he could play again.
Peyton was able to convince Brees and his wife Brittany to visit New Orleans. But the recruiting visit didn't go entirely as planned.
I'm driving the car, and it's Drew in the front seat, Brittany in the back seat, and I'm driving like I've been a resident for 10 years, and I've only been here for a couple months. So we went over to the North Shore to look at some housing. We came back, and somewhere off the causeway, I ended up spun around, and I know I was heading towards Baton Rouge, and now just over and back to the North Shore is going to take an hour and a half, you know. And so there's that point. I look in the rearview mirror, and I see Brittany just kind of nodding off, you know, and I'm thinking I might as well just like drive him to the airport and put him on the Miami Dolphins plane.
I remember looking to my left and seeing a house with, or literally just a concrete slab, no house. And then seeing another house that was halfway off the foundation with a truck upside down in the living room. And then we had to stop because there was a tugboat sitting literally like in the middle of the road upside down. And it was that moment where I looked at Brittany and just kept, where our eyes met, and we knew that this was so much bigger than just football. And I think we both felt the calling there to New Orleans, that this was not just about the resurgence of a football team or an organization, but it was about the rebirth of the city.
With a quarterback in place, that made preparing for the 2006 draft that much easier. Mario Williams, an imposing pass rush specialist from North Carolina State, and Reggie Bush, a Heisman Trophy winning tailback from USC, were the top two non-quarterbacks on most draft boards. A day before the draft, the Texans announced they were going to draft Williams, leaving the dynamic Bush available for the Saints at number two.
Reggie Bush.
It was a 9-0 on the Richter scale.
Our equipment assisted in clearing streets to where Entergy could restore power to homes. I was at the game.
It was definitely a big to-do. I had a t-shirt on that said Home Sweet Dome on it.
There's no way that Atlanta could win this game with it being the reopening of the Superdome.
The blocked punt was just the cherry on top.
And all the emotion of the city just erupted. That was like a starting point of everybody's healing.
I mean, this has become the newest old city in the world.
While the Saints were putting their team together, the state of Louisiana, SMG, and a small army of contractors were working nearly round the clock to rebuild the Superdome. The state and SMG had refinanced the dome's debt and used that extra money, along with FEMA and insurance payments, to make sure the rebuilt Superdome wasn't going to be the same old building. At the same time, the NFL was working on plans to make the pregame entertainment before the reopening game Super Bowl worthy.
There was a guy that was working for me named David Saltz, who was a consultant, and he kept saying to me, look, I can get you two to do this. And I was like, well, if you can get you two to do this, I'll put myself on the line and basically say to everybody, you know, we're getting in the way, we're going to interfere because we think we can do a much bigger show.
Ezrin, a legendary music producer, became involved because he and a group of his friends in the music industry had formed a charity, Music Rising, to help all of the New Orleans musicians and bands who had lost their instruments to the floodwaters of Katrina. The group's immediate goal was to raise $1.2 million to help replace instruments for 1,200 musicians.
A few weeks after the flood, U2 were coming through Toronto. They were actually playing, and I was there. So we were there, and I was sitting next to the edge. And being the brazen guy that I am, I said to him, hey, look, you know, we're going to be replacing a lot of instruments that were lost in the Gulf South. You got any guitars you don't need? I figured, rock star, he's going to say, sure, and then I'll never hear from him again. But he said, I can do better than that. And I said, well, here's my home number. If you come up with anything, give me a call. Sure enough, that weekend, just a few days later, I got a call from Edge. He said, okay, I've spoken to Yamaha, I've spoken to this one, I've spoken to that one, I've spoken to Live Nation, I've gotten these people to agree to put this money in, this company to agree to sell us instruments, and I was like, and he kept saying, we, us, we, and I thought, okay, partner, here we go.
We started Music Rising, and we're very proud to say that within 6 months, we'd started to get a lot of equipment replaced and a lot of musicians back to work, which was our original phase one, was the music had to continue, not just because it was, you know, where music is, hope abounds. If the music is silenced, you know, it just feeds into people's sense of desperation. So bringing back music had an important role to play, we felt, in the regeneration of the city, but it was also the continuity. We just wanted to make sure that this wonderful tradition and music culture of New Orleans was maintained, supported, that it survived, that we didn't look back in 20 years and go, well, the great New Orleans music culture pre-Katrina and then afterwards kind of had been, you know, dissipated.
So both Edge and I made separate trips in the fall and winter of 2005 to see what was going on, and it was astounding. I mean, honestly, like visiting the dark side of the moon when you went down to the Ninth Ward and beyond moving. It strengthened my resolve that this was something that we had to fix. And what our thought was if they play it, others will come. If the music is playing, people will come back. Without the music, there is no heart to the Gulf. And so that became our mission, put the music back.
And then Ezrin and Edge were approached by the league about playing the reopening game.
So the initial idea was that, you know, they'd like us to put together an event that was inspired, obviously, by New Orleans and the music of New Orleans, but, you know, might include some international artists. And I thought on this for a while. I said, well, definitely we should do something. I'm not sure what it would be at first. And then Bob says, you know, maybe we could bring in a guest or two and you can perform with maybe another singer. We might get, maybe Billy Joe from Green Day might do it. So I know Billy Joe. So I reached out and said, you know, would you be interested? It's kind of a pretty amazing opportunity to perform at such an event. So Billy Joe immediately said, yeah, I'm in. Great. What are we going to do?
So Edge came up with this song called The Saints Are Coming by a little-known band called The Skids, an old punk band, you know, and I vaguely knew the song, but the minute I played it again, I went, oh my God, this is perfect.
I thought for a couple of days, and then it just came to me, this song, my favorite song when I was like 17 years old, written and performed by a band called The Skids from Ayrshire in Scotland, was a song called The Saints Are Coming. And I thought, wow, that's obvious, because Billy Joe is so inspired by music of punk rock, and we started out as a band kind of post that musical movement. So a lot of our roots are punk rock roots. It's the perfect combination for us to sing that song. So I called Billy Joe and said, what about The Saints Are Coming? You know, I'd sent him the song, and he loved it. So that was our first idea, and it was, you know, we're very happy about that. And then I was playing the tune and I shared this idea with Bono and Adam and Larry. And it, the idea, well, you know, maybe we could get the whole band to come along. That would be really cool. So I asked them what they thought. So they, okay, sounds like it could work. So, you know, with one of these things, it's kind of once you get one little piece of the puzzle in place, you can start to get the other things. So I talked to Billy Joe. I said, Billy Joe, I think maybe you two might come on board. What about Green Day? What about the whole band? And he said, I think that would be really cool. Let me go and check. So bit by bit, we got everyone on side for this idea. And then we happened to be recording in London in Abbey Road with Rick Rubin. So we looked at diaries. It turned out that Green Day were free. So they flew over, spent like 3 days in Abbey Road, the same room the Beatles recorded all their most important studio recordings. And we had 2 days of amazing time playing together and recording. And of those sessions, that song was the strongest thing that we came out with. And so it seemed like at that point a no-brainer to lead with that track. And of course we made it a benefit for Music Rising. So it earned a lot of money for our charity. And and then, you know, that came out to a lot of attention. And you know, we knew then that was absolutely had to be part of our performance at the Superdome.
Quint Davis was brought on board to help stage the production, and legendary Grammys producer Ken Ehrlich was hired to run the TV production of the performances.
We had two or three days of run-throughs, you know, like a super, to stage, because we had this giant thing that we built that had to roll in and roll out. We had two. We didn't have just have U2. We had U2 and Green Day. And then we had like Trombone Shorty and Kermit Ruffin. We had two whole brass bands. We had two whole social aid and pleasure clubs.
This was one of those shows where everybody was pushing in the right direction. Everybody's heart was in the right place. And seeing these musicians on stage and the way things were being planned and the music that Bob Ezrin and the producer put together, the rehearsals were really, really special. And when Bono started to improvise Beautiful Day and started to, you know, after the flood, the colors come out, you really started to get goosebumps.
You know, it's funny, we showed up at the Superdome and I think we were all kind of a little nervous because there was so much that had to be done in that rehearsal, you know, integrating Tom and Shorty and the other musicians and two bands that hadn't really played together that much, so we sound check and all. It was quite a high and intense moment.
I don't think I ever captured that emotion again. Years later, it was just a monumental thing. That moment let us know that if we had any doubt of coming back to New Orleans, we're here now, and from this moment we can build and make sure the city is okay.
Our equipment assisted in clearing streets to where Entergy could restore power to homes. I was at the game.
It was definitely a big to-do. I had a t-shirt on that said Home Sweet Dome on it.
There's no way that Atlanta could win this game with it being the reopening of the Superdome.
The blocked punt was just the cherry on top.
And all the emotion of the city just erupted. That was like a starting point of everybody's healing.
I mean, this has become the newest old city in the world.
The 2006 Saints gathered for training camp at Millsaps College in Jackson, Mississippi, about 3 hours north of New Orleans. Practices were hard. temperatures were hot, and the Saints looked like a team a long ways away from being a playoff contender.
Obviously, it was going to be a tough camp. We were going to try to really challenge the players and build a foundation and really create an environment where toughness was going to be what made it. And, you know, there weren't many restrictions then. And so we were going 2-a-day, and it was hot, obviously. I'd be willing to say it was probably one of the more difficult training camps in our league's history.
You could maybe relate it to, you know, the weeding out period of a boot camp, you know, or of a military training, you know, where you're trying to find the best of the best, and you're trying to set the tone, and you're trying to break everybody down to the point that you can then build them back up together as one, as a unit, and truly build the foundation of what will be our organization moving forward. I think that was the vision that Sean Payton had in his mind when we went to Jackson.
Man, it was tough, but the players that came through that, I think they would all say, as tough as it was, it made us better.
Honestly, the season started off in training camp, I would say, average to poor. We struggled in some of those preseason games. Deuce was still recovering from an ACL. Drew still wasn't 100%.
We were abysmal during the preseason. And, you know, listen, a part of that was because we were gassed. I mean, that training camp was so physical and so tough and so long and so draining that by the time you got to the games, you didn't have anything left. And guys were fighting for survival, really. I mean, in general terms, you were each day, you know, at some point during the practice, you just went into survival mode. You know, it's like, how do we get through this?
The Saints started the season at Cleveland and scratched out a victory.
That was an important win. You know, it was a low-scoring game. Then we go to Green Bay. We fall down 13-0, but bounce back and are able to get back in the game.
I felt like that Green Bay game was pretty important to us.
But nothing was going to be more important than the reopening game, which pitted the Saints against their longtime rival, the Falcons, also undefeated.
I think one of the best things Sean did was he took the entire team to have our Friday practice, which took place on a Saturday, in the Superdome prior to the Monday night game. And this, for many of us, was our first time in the Dome ever. And certainly post-Katrina for the guys that had been there. And, you know, it was a bit eerie, but we got through the practice, and you're sitting there just imagining all that had taken place there over the past 6 months or a year. And then at the end of the practice, he calls us all up, and the lights go out. And then up on the Jumbotron, he plays a video for us, just kind of documenting the storm, the devastation, what had happened in the Dome, and then what this game represented for so many people. And there wasn't a dry eye, you know, amongst the team as we watched that video. But we all knew right then and there that we were going to win this game because we had to.
I remember our focus being just on the routine and making sure players knew how to get to the stadium. You know, more than 50% of the team hadn't played the year before. And so we had valet parking, we had the hotel we were staying at, making sure they beat traffic. There were all these steps in place just to make sure on Monday they were ready to play the game.
The two things I remember that were unique to my experience were, they wanted every player to use this weird red carpet valet service that was right in the middle of the arriving crowd. I didn't want to do that, so I drove in the back entrance and parked in my spot. The other moment was during the national anthem minutes before kickoff. I vividly remember looking across the field and seeing the Falcons, and looking up at the crowd in the Dome and thinking, it is impossible for us to lose tonight.
It was only going to be a special night if we won. In other words, we did not want to have that reopening and the national televised game and lose the game. You know, it had to be with us winning. because it was one of those once-in-a-lifetime moments that was much bigger than the sport itself.
Never seen a stadium for a regular season game like that. It was a Super Bowl-type energy in the building, but it was different because it was real passion. It came from the heart. It wasn't just, hey, our team is playing. No, our city is playing.
One of the things that I thought was important was to do some form of a reveal. Something that said, okay, now the Superdome is open. And we did that with the big banner reveal on the outside of the building.
I get a call from, I don't recall if it was from the Saints or the Superdome people, whatever, they were going to have a countdown. People are going to be out. They weren't going to open the dome until 5:30 or something. We're going to have a countdown. They'd like for you to get up on this big deal and count it down. I said, shoot, yeah, I'm honored. I'll be there.
Once inside, when the pregame show started, the U2 and Green Day performance was just one of these things where even during the rehearsal, when we were watching rehearsal, we were looking at each other and saying, this was an important thing to do. This is not something you even have to pay us for. I would do this for free.
Now, please welcome two of the world's greatest rock and roll bands, U2 and Green Day, ushered in by some of New Orleans' finest brash musicians.
Billy Joe comes out and starts singing House of the Rising Sun, and of course, this is a room where just one year before people had been dying. And the smell of that was still in the air.
When Billy Joe Armstrong sang, you know, there is a house in New Orleans they call the Superdome. I mean, I still get chills when I think about it now. I mean, incredible how they tailored that moment. And it couldn't have been more effective and more powerful.
There is a house in New Orleans they call.
And then came the statement of defiance. The Saints are coming. And everyone had come to the Saints game. This was, in a way, New Orleans. This was New Orleans standing up. This was New Orleans getting off its knees and standing up and saying to the world, we're back. All the lights on when the chorus came and flooded the place and the audience in bright white light. At that moment, New Orleans was rebuilt.
Here when we walking up, the people that they ran on the field, oh my God, this is amazing. You know, y'all get to play with U2 and Green Day to represent the city. And that part, when he mentioned the names, that wasn't part of the rehearsal, so I had no idea that he was going to do that. But I do remember being on stage, all of those people, and when he mentioned each one of our names, you can hear like a big roar in the crowd. That was a very, very proud moment for all of us.
I think when we saw the response of the crowd at the event, I think we realized that this was a coming together of so many things, and its significance started to dawn on me particularly. And after the show, it was really getting out and talking to people, the locals, Quint, Trombone Shorty, his cousins and musician friends, and the guys from Preservation Hall. Started to realize that this is big. This is bigger than I thought.
It's almost like an alarm clock, you know. For the last year and a half, since the Katrina had hit, we've been living a nightmare. And, you know, the alarm was going off. The song was waking us up.
New Orleans!
When the show was over, we had a big gathering in the dressing room of U2, and Bono, unaccustomed as he is to public speaking, gave a little speech about the meaning of this thing and acknowledged everybody that was involved. And there was a kind of feeling of solidarity in the room. We had just made history.
One of the cool things was when the show was over, when the pregame was over, I remember just walking towards the stage and Larry Mullen, the drummer of U2, who I had not spoken to at all, he just slapped me five, and I slapped him five, and he went his way, and I went mine.
Boy, I had no idea was that the song, The Saints Are Coming, was going to be adopted in the way it has been. And I have to say, that's very proud to realize that that has happened. And it was great fun also to talk to some of the guys from the Skids and kind of explain to them, because they were like, had no idea what was going on. Suddenly, for them to have one of their songs be such an important part of, you know, sports team on the other side of the world was kind of mind-blowing for me.
We were in the locker room when that took place, and so now when you see the video of it and you hear it, you just think of that night, you know, that again, I think every one of us felt fortunate that, blessed that we were in that position to be a part of the recovery. If you didn't at the beginning, you quickly got on board and recognized that this was more than we got into this sport for. I mean, I wanted to become a coach, but this was a little bit more about a bigger thing than just winning games.
Two of the main icons of New Orleans music, Irma Thomas and Alan Toussaint, came onto the field to perform the anthem.
Normally I do the national anthem a cappella, but this particular time they decided to pair me up along with Alan Toussaint. And we did a quick rehearsal backstage as the dome is for backstage. And that was the first time I've actually sung it with accompaniment.
By the dawn's
early light. I think one of the challenges for any artist singing a national anthem is you got a lot to lose and not a lot to gain. You know, we hear about the mistakes made during anthems. Every once in a while, you hear about Whitney Houston, you know, hitting it out of the park. Well, Irma Thomas hit it out of the park. You know, at that moment, that was the person that should have been singing the anthem. And And so, you know, you have goosebumps, you're numb, you know, you're trying to stay in the moment, but it was special.
And the rocket's red glare, the bomb bursting in air.
It was odd because once we finished singing it, normally they immediately start applauding. But for some reason on that day, if there wasn't a good 30-second pause, which in 30 seconds on TV is a long time, a good 30-second pause before everybody started applauding, and I think there wasn't a dry eye in the house, including mine. For some reason, it just meant we were home. And there's a big difference when you're finally realizing you're somewhere that you thought you would not be, and it hits you. And for 30 whole seconds, we just stood there, and it was like, wow, we are home.
She was singing it from a different place, you know, singing it to make sure the city, this is the beginning to us rebuilding. And you can hear it in her voice, how touching it was for her to be able to be there and represent at that level. And then for us to come along, it was just it captured everything that New Orleans had, from football to music to the Queen of Soul.
It still gives me chills to hear the U2 and Green Day, "The Saints Are Coming." Man, it's awesome. And so many New Orleans legends, you know, in and around that as well. Like you said, Irma Thomas and Alan Toussaint. We knew that it was going to be a spectacle. You know, I mean, we knew that Monday Night Football, two undefeated teams, reopening the dome, I mean, just all the festivities that come along with that. And yet, there was a laser focus on our team, and we knew we had to take care of business, and we knew we had to start fast too. And I don't think we could have started that game off any better than we did.
A moment almost unimaginable 13 months ago is here. The NFL, the Saints, back in New Orleans, back in the Superdome. Russell from the 5. And a nice return to the 29-yard line. And that brings Michael Vick and the Atlanta Falcons out to the field. Vick lost the football. Goes out of bounds. New Orleans did not have possession. It's still Atlanta ball, but it's fourth down. Fujita came in and freed it out of Vick's hand.
The plan wasn't to rush the first punt. I don't know if we had a plan in regards to when we were going to rush the punt, but typically you rush six. Sometimes when you're going to go after it, you rush eight. And John Bonamago, our special teams coordinator, he just as third down had been run, he said, "Do you want to rush this first one?" And so my reaction was, yeah, you know. And so, but that wasn't it's not like we spent all week saying we're going to rush the first punt, but where the ball was at on their side of the field, we did, and Steve did a great job. He timed it up.
I was a little surprised to hear the block called after the first series. especially in the field position, which usually calls for a return. The scheme is an interior stunt, where I cross from the right A-gap to the left A-gap. Sure enough, the Falcons had some confusion on their assignments. They tried some bizarre slide scheme, which I'd never seen in 8 seasons. So, I actually didn't hit the A-gap like it was drawn up. Because they used the slide technique, I actually ended up unblocked, and the B-gap opened up for me.
I remember we had it in the plan, and it was one of those, hey, right moment, and hey, we got the look that we wanted on that first punt. And so as I'm standing there, I'm trying to act cool. It's one of those acting jobs where you don't want to act too excited about what's happening down there with the punt. You know, I kind of look like I'm getting locked in for the drive, but in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, all right, we got the punt block on. Come on, Steve-O. Come on, Gleese. And then sure enough, it sets up perfectly. And he blocks that punt. It was like a shotgun blast.
He didn't punch. Oh, yeah, yeah. It's going inside the five. Now and it is up. Going to be covered by the Saints for a touchdown. Oh, baby. What a moment. Just listen to this
in
crowd.
In the back of my mind, I had thought later on that afternoon as I was kind of going to the game that if the Saints do score, the first thing I want to say is touchdown New Orleans. Because it wasn't touchdown Saints. It was a New Orleans moment. And with the energy that was in the building and had built up through the music and then that play, it was just the perfect time. And I remember saying touchdown New Orleans, and then I just, and I've done that in other places, but just kind of put my hands out to make sure nobody said anything. Because there was nothing any human alive could say that could be better than that moment.
I give Tony Kornheiser credit because words in the moment were priceless, I thought.
Not to script this any better than it just happened for the New Orleans Saints. Everybody thought that the wave of emotion would come in with the Saints. If you were the Falcons, the first thing you had to be afraid of is being swept away in that particular wave of emotion. That is exactly what happened now. And for those people who look to the New Orleans Saints as something that will uplift them, uplift this city, uplift the entire Gulf region, they just had it.
That moment to me was a defining moment in the city's rebirth. It was a belief that the city could be better than it was before, and that is such a rare and unusual thing to be a part of as an athlete.
It was transcendent. What happened in our experience was that what we did in the music and the song was tied to the punt block. From, you know, the Saints are coming. They came. They blocked the punt. They scored a touchdown. They won the game.
Just remember the noise. You know, I remember Curtis DeLoach scoring and spiking it. But I can't recall Steve's reaction because it was just so loud that it was kind of a, you know, we scored. You know, we're not going to get shut out in this game. You know, scoring first with that crowd was significant in that. It was as loud a stadium that night that we've ever experienced, that I've ever experienced.
You know, you're just pumped up and excited, and the crowd is you know, never been that loud ever. And, you know, then there's tears being shed. It's just, man, it's just a perfect play at a perfect time.
I don't think I've been to any ball game or any other event with a crowd of people that were more joyful and just shouting for joy when Steve Gleason blocked that ball.
All of the times there seemed to be a moment where we could have turned the corner as an organization and we went the wrong way. For some reason, that night it felt like we finally turned the corner and we were heading the right direction.
The most impactful, I mean, it's the most impactful game that I've done on literally over 1,000 events, not just football, baseball, basketball, just because of the responsibility we had that night and the meaning of what that game was for the people. The game was secondary to the event and the rebirth of a city. And so that made that night more than anything super special for all of us.
There was so much emotion and passion in the Dome that night. The people of New Orleans had spent the previous 12 months being devastated and frustrated and angry. This was their chance to release all those emotions and to let the world know the city of New Orleans was back. Because I had been in New Orleans for the previous 6 seasons, at least to some degree, I understood the culture and mentality of New Orleans. I was dating and would later marry into New Orleans family. I also endured the chaos of the previous 13 months. As a result, the significance of the block, even in the moments immediately after the play, was not lost on me.
Complete, like, elation. It was an eruption. But it was just, it was such a bang, bang. And if you didn't know that we were going to win prior to that moment, then you knew what the result was going to be from there on. And basically, it was a resounding, not only are we going to win this game, but New Orleans, we are back.
I can't split this ball up 500,000 ways. I can't do that. I can't cut it up into 500,000 pieces, all right, to give to everybody in this city. But this game ball is going to everybody in this city. This city is getting this game ball from our organization, this team. This game ball is going to the city of New Orleans.
The impact of September 25th, 2006. The performances of U2 and Green Day, Irma's national anthem, Steve Gleason's block, still resonates today, 10 years later.
Be at the Dome, back in the Dome, no matter what the situation was outside, it was a way to get away from having to think about, well, I got to get my house together, I got to do this, I got to do that. We can forget it for whatever time you're spending in that Dome. All that just went away for that moment, and it was a come together, and it was just special.
Bigger than a football game for us, you know, for the city, for the team, for the musicians. It represented more than just football.
I think that a lot of credit goes to the Saints. Drew Brees was fairly new at the time, and he took the city to heart. He became the symbol of a winning team, and that was the other thing that happened. The Saints transformed themselves from a team on the margins to a winning team. And that elevated the whole state.
You didn't realize it at the time, but all of a sudden you found yourself in this event at this period of time that you realized, you know, it was going to be something remembered long after you were here.
I think it was a sign that, hey, we can do it. We can be a championship organization. We can deliver a championship. We can be a championship city. We could be a championship community. You know, we are different. That's what makes New Orleans so great. We do things a little bit differently, but that doesn't mean we can't be successful. We can't be champions. And that night, again, was the first step in our journey to winning a championship. And, you know, it was one heck of an experience.
Well, I have to say, for me personally, it's probably the pinnacle, because, you know, this was a initiative that I started. The idea, the genesis of this song was something that came to me in response to that request to perform. So, you know, it's very personal to me. In a sort of U2 context, I think it's way up there, because it's everything that U2 are about as a band. You know, we were so proud to being able to give back in this way. And the fact that the song lives on in this way was totally unforeseen, and just an incredible, I would say, an honor.
No one ninth will rise again above the waters of Lake Pontchartrain.
I'd say my lasting memory from the Monday night game, reopening of the Dome, Atlanta Falcons, was just the feeling that we can really accomplish anything. Who would have thought a year earlier, after everything that had transpired, that we would be sitting here doing this? I mean, we felt like, you know what, we can do anything, we can accomplish anything. I'm not just talking about the team scoring touchdowns, winning football games. You know, I'm talking about the city, the people. Like, New Orleans is not just going to come back, we're going to come back stronger than ever.